Welcome to Real World Theology, the Halloween episode 2015. On this episode, we're going to be talking about Crimson Peak. Joining me are two horror gurus, experts, if you will, James Harleman from Cinemagogue and J.R. Forresteros from the Don't Split Up podcast, and many other podcasts, but we'll get to that later. Crimson Peak actually has been talked a lot about how maybe it has been mismarketed and maybe shouldn't be considered a horror movie. So we dive into that. We talk about what is horror, can this be horror, can that be horror, why even talk about horror, especially in spiritual or religious circles. Why is this something we should even tackle? But if nothing else, I would say that we were going to go see this movie anyway, based on the fact that it's the next film by Guillermo del Toro. We're all big del Toro fans. We've liked all his work. We think he's incredibly creative and fantastical. But so we dive into what he's done, how he's bringing something to the horror genre. We talk about the benefits of examining good horror, and we talk about maybe what is good horror and what's not good horror, and how we can use ghosts and zombies and vampires and werewolves to really explore the things that we fear the most. So make sure you guys are checking out realworldtheology.com. That's where you'll find more stuff from Harleman and Forresteros. You'll find new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts daily. You'll go to Facebook. Find us on Facebook. We're always posting things on Facebook. We're always posting things on Twitter. Follow us at Real World Theo. Subscribe to the podcast. You can look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, 20th of the month, and occasionally on special holidays like Halloween. So subscribe during Feedburner, Stitcher, iTunes. Rate and review the show. Tell your friends. We'll get more people involved in the conversation. It'll make everything better. But for now, we have a really great show for you. So here it is. Episode 77, Crimson Peak, and Exploring Our Monsters. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I also unabashedly, we use our name for everything, by the way. Our house is Harlem Manor, our anniversary is Harloween, my Twitter is Harlemanic, we had a blog called The Harlemaniacs. It's kind of versatile, really.
So you're like Chang in Community.
Yes, except when people try to use it to twist and say I'm Hardly Man, then that's
so that's just mean.
That's the downside.
Well, other than that, it's just good marketing, right?
Yes. I probably could have come up with something smarter than Cinemagogue. Looking back, I probably should have tried to tie it in with Harlem Movies. You know,
Harlem Movies.
I think you're good.
Yeah, Cinemagogue was, I think, pretty great because the rest of us are sitting out here with some form of reel, you know, and it just, I thought it was pretty creative at first, and I'm like, and it's like real spirituality, real gospel, real, just everyone's using the reel thing, and then the irony is no one actually uses reels really anymore I feel outdated.
Seems kind of fake, man.
Mm-hmm. You know, 20th Century Fox is hanging in there, Mikey, you can too.
Is that what I want to associate myself with?
I think the new Star Wars is shot on film. Read that yesterday. JJ shot it on actual film.
Of course he did, because all he's trying to do is make sure everyone knows that he's seen the original trilogy.
Well, we just had this discussion. So me and Mark, a guy on the show. Actually, I think James, you've been on with him. We were just talking about this, and he was lamenting the fact that Bridge of Spies looks like it's a terribly boring movie. And I said, well, actually, most people who I know who've seen it said that it was pretty great. They really enjoyed it. They thought it was, had some of the Spielberg pitfalls. It was like overtly hopeful in a scenario that probably shouldn't have been depicted as overtly hopeful, et cetera, et cetera.
Tom Hanks played one character.
Tom Hanks played Tom Hanks that he plays in every movie. But I was like, I don't think maybe it's quite as bad as you're thinking it's going to be. And he said, why won't Spielberg get back to making those, you know, wondrous films, those iconic films that he made in our childhood? And I said, I think you just need to embrace the fact that J.J. Abrams fills that void right now.
J.J. Abrams is the new Spielberg.
He, I mean, like, and I would welcome pushback on that, but I think it's the most apt description of what Abrams is doing right now.
The problem is, he just really wants you to know that that's what he's doing.
I think that, well, but, you know, come on, I mean, you know, P.T. Barnum was pretty unabashed too, but he put on a good show. So, I mean, like, you're right. He's kind of the master of his own hype. But I would, if somebody asked me, and now somebody will shoot me for saying this, but if somebody asked me, like, I'd really like to see the quintessential Spielberg film, I would have them watch Super 8.
So, oh, yeah.
Now, did you guys see that just today the Vulture put out a definitive ranking of, well, definitive for Vulture people, Vulture. I guess.
Yeah.
But a ranking of all 29 of his films.
Mm-mm.
I haven't read it yet. I saw it, but.
It's too new. You've got your finger on the pulse, JR.
Raiders was number one.
Of course.
E.T. was number two.
Eh, overrated.
Hook was number 28.
What?
Wait, which one?
Hook.
Oh, I think Hook gets a bad rap. That's just me personally. Maybe it hit me at a weird, cutesy, optimistic time in my life, but I enjoyed the spirit of Hook. It certainly wouldn't be in the top 10, but I don't know about putting it down. What was the worst? What was number 29?
Like the newest Indiana Jones?
Yeah, Crystal Skull. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, deserved.
Okay, yeah. So that's deserved. But then what you're saying is Hook is only one slot better than Crystal Skull, and Hook.
It ranked AI like number 13.
So overrated. Now you've basically made like no reason to go look at this list now.
Yeah. Well, there's I'm sure there are plenty of other groans or cheers to be had throughout that all 20. But
yeah, probably right.
So when I think of corresponding directors, JR, I don't remember if I had this conversation with you, and if I did, I apologize. But because you'll probably be able to help remind me. But there was this comparison made by like new directors coming in, especially Hispanic directors, and they compared Alfonso Cuarón, Iñárritu, and Del Toro to what was it, like Scorsese and Spielberg and someone else maybe.
Was it Ridley maybe, or
I don't think it was Ridley Scott. I want to say it was Coppola maybe.
Kubrick.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Because I think Del Toro was like the Mexican Spielberg, making movies that were like that had a touch of wonder in them. Let's see, Iñárritu was the Coppola maybe.
I could see him as the Kubrick too, with his attention to the visual.
Yeah, that too. But anyway, like there's this comparison made about like how like we need to embrace these new directors because they are paving like this new like everything that we loved about film, like in the late 70s, 80s kind of time. You know, when most of us were growing up, like that's what we're getting now. We're just getting it with a different generation of directors, and it's even more impressive that we're like. These directors are the ones that were influenced by the directors that, you know, influenced our film love.
Right.
And we just need to kind of sit back and enjoy it. No, I'd say good.
I was going to say, although my favorite one of the year was my favorite film of the year is by somebody who has aged well. I think I'm still of the mind that George Miller gave us the definitive Max film.
Unquestionably.
And the best, and my favorite of the year. There's still some of the year to go. There's obviously December 18th, but Max has taken the year for me so far.
Hmm. Well, see, so the problem, the hiccup that I would have mentioning George Miller among that group is I feel like his catalog is a lot smaller.
True.
You know, it's like a director who shows up and makes a really great film, and it is impressive that, you know, like 30 years later, he can make an even more impressive film. But in the middle, we're having to endure like Happy Feet, and
so you're penalizing for being a good dad.
I know. Happy Feet isn't even a good dad thing. That's just like you wanted to make an animated movie, and it's still a terrible animated movie.
Like, I never saw Happy Feet. I didn't.
No,
care to,
Okay. In my opinion, it is not a very good movie. But if I want, like, when you say penalizing someone for being a good dad, that's why I don't lament Brendan Fraser being in all these like kind of dumb kid movies, because he's like, I want to be in movies that my kids can see, and like, I wouldn't probably go see most of the movies that he's in. Like, that's what I think of.
I will totally penalize being a good dad, because that's how we got Star Wars prequels. All right.
Touche.
I mean, that's one explanation. Another one is that he just got too big for his britches.
Well, that is also true. It was a cocktail. Let's be fair. Yes.
Well, so and lots of that is the fact that we're reviewing these right. Well, we're doing minisodes on these right now. They'll be coming out later this month. Well, later in November, I guess, by the time this episode airs. And we talk about these prequels, and we talk about how they're almost comedic. Like, it's not like, why are characters stepping in poo? You know, why are people making funny sounds? It's not that there wasn't some tongue in cheek in the original Star Wars trilogy, but it was never like silly, really.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh gosh.
I've told you my theory on that, right?
I don't. Well, if you have, I want to hear it again.
All right, you're either a Three Stooges guy or an Abbott and Costello guy. The first trilogy is Abbott and Costello. The humor is primarily derived from wordplay. The prequels fundamentally embrace Three Stooges. It's based on eye poking and tripping and slapping. Mm. You can make an argument in one sense. You know, people who want to say, "Oh, it's just nostalgia why you like the old ones." It's like, no, the comedy is fundamentally a different style.
Oh, very.
And so you can't say they're the same. You can make an argument. Now, there's plenty of Three Stooges fans that will say, shut up, how dare you denigrate the Three Stooges and compare them to the Star Wars prequels. But
rightfully so.
But it's the same brand of humor, right? Same kind.
The tone fundamentally took a very different thread. And so it's like, well, on that alone, you could say, I don't like them because they're fundamentally different in tone. So... I think that's fair. Even if some people want to defend them, some people, I have 20 something friends who grew up with them, and their love of Star Wars came through that, and they love the originals too.
Yeah.
I can't be too angry at the gateway drug, even if I feel like it's diluted.
The ends justify the means.
Say what you will about marijuana. If it got them to heroin, it can't be all bad. It
can't be all that bad.
Darn straight.
Well, so we're talking comedy, but I obviously brought you heavy hitters in horror here for a reason. Unfortunately, not the Halloween special episode, but the Halloween episode gives us a chance on this podcast to talk about films that we typically don't cover. For two reasons. One, they're not incredibly popular among Christians. Unfortunately, it's not popular among Christians. Understandably, most of the people that listen to this podcast are probably come from a Christian background, if nothing else. So they're not seeing a lot of these horror movies that come out during the year. But we've already had a chance to do It Follows, which was great. And outside of that, the other reason is that, you know, it's kind of like any other, like a romantic comedy genre or... like a sexploitation kind of thing. It's easy to do, like, to take horror too far and actually just miss the entire point of horror. So we get to pick a good horror film or scary film, and we actually put Crimson Peak on the schedule based on the marketing, and I know we'll get to talk about this at some point, but we assumed that it was going to be this horror film, and like I said, we'll talk about how it's not, but... I think it's still,
or is it?
Yeah. So it still completely fits the theme that we're going for on this Halloween episode. Because if nothing else, I think basically if Guillermo del Toro directs anything, it's appropriate to watch at Halloween. I mean, because he's always dealing in the fantastic, and I love that. So we have this is his next big movie. Actually, we didn't learn a lot about the plot. in the trailer, like, you know, there were some bits and pieces, but nothing, a whole lot you could put together. Or what you put together, again, like we kind of hinted at and we'll probably talk about, is that it was not what we got. So this movie was really pushed as a Guillermo del Toro, his next big thing, which, again, was enough for me. But then when you added, you know, Jessica Chastain and Tom Hiddleston, then I was on board. And then even more so, not Edith Cushing, that's a character, Mia Wasikowska. I'm just, anyone feels to correct me at any point. And then Charlie Hunnam, who is a superstar because of Pacific Rim, you know, who crushed it. Probably an Oscar snub for his work and his groundbreaking performance in Pacific Rim. You know, we have a solid cast, and so I was ready. And the thing that is interesting to me about Crimson Peak is that Laura and I go see about everything together. And I think I'm not alone in this boat, even though I think it's rare, because if I'm correct, and you guys can correct, set me straight, but James, I'm pretty sure you and Kat share a lot of the same likes as far as film goes.
Amen.
And JR, you and Amanda, I like a lot of the same things.
Correct.
Yeah. So I think we're actually anomalies that way.
Correct.
She was wanting to see Crimson Peak about, and don't get me wrong, I wanted to see Crimson Peak, one of the top 10 most excited for films of the year.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to see it 10 times beyond that.
You wanted to see it.
When we thought we might be heading to California to ride on her to ride roller coasters, which is her single most favorite thing in the universe, but it meant we might be at Magic Mountain instead of at Crimson Peak's opening day. She was trying to score free tickets for screeners everywhere because we had to. It was a very bizarre. I'm kind of, you know, I Tom Hiddleston's in it. I got a little worried, but. She's not quite on the Loki train like all these other ladies, so it's all right.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, there was an excitement, and, you know, Laura heard about it. Laura's a big fan of, you know, what Guillermo del Toro has done, even though it kind of freaks her out a little bit. And that's what's kind of weird, because even though we have incredibly similar taste, and I would just as likely join her for a Pride and Prejudice as she would join us for, like, an Avengers. But horror is kind of where she draws the line. And honestly, it's not my favorite thing, though I think a good horror movie is hard to beat. So with Crimson Peak, I was kind of determined to see it for Del Toro alone. And it meant I was going to have to kind of go see it before her and let her know. But then I started reading some of the reviews that said it wasn't a horror film at all. I think JR, you know, you guys put it out on, I think Don't Split Up right before I went to go see it. That kind of questioned what it was about and how the marketing was wrong. And so I almost got her to see it, but, you know, she was like, well, I'd rather be on the safe side. So, so I'll start with this. If this isn't a horror film, if Crimson Peak is not a horror film, then what would you describe this film as, James?
All right. This goes back to another argument that's happened more recently about other films. So I appreciate what Guillermo del Toro and others are doing in calling it a gothic romance so that people will go into it to get the vibe that they think that – I think that their description is probably helpful for most people. My problem is that most people are wrong. And I ran into this by showing – we've been showing some of our younger friends things like the old Hammer horror films, like Fall of the House of Usher with Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. And the Peter Cushing, perfect name for Edith, by the way. Uh-huh. That was not an error. The old Peter Cushing films, the old Christopher Lee films. You know, the Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing Dracula film is rated G. Wow. Did you know that? So you go and watch these movies like, – and even as early, as late as Kenneth Branagh's version of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein with Robert De Niro, you watch these, and I've shown them to people, and they're just like, well, these aren't horror movies. Like, it was just sort of like it's romantic and sweeping and the visuals, and like, sure, there's some disturbing elements, but it's not a horror movie. It's like we have, as a culture, when we say horror movies, all we think are jump cuts and cats and shutting the refrigerator and somebody's there. Mm-hmm. And we have so misdefined horror as this sort of intense jolt moment movie that we don't understand that the horror of ideas is what fundamentally, I mean, when Mary Shelley and even Bram Stoker in his original book, like, the horror is about months later when these ideas just seep into your dreams and the dark foreboding. And you go back and read Lovecraft. So much of Lovecraft, the characters are archaeologically pulling up these old cultures, and like the threat and the danger aren't imminent. It's the ideas that are disturbing. And so I understand that they're using their words and couching them carefully to get to get the right audience in there. But by my definition, this is true horror. I would say it's gothic horror. They're trying to say it's gothic romance, so they get the but good horror has always had an undercurrent of sort of a melancholy, fated, doomed love aspect to it. So I'm a little all over the map with my understanding. I want to tell everybody it's horror, but I understand then everybody's going to think it's Jason with a machete.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to go. But well,
that's not good because you're not helping me out, James. Because when I came back, I was like, Laura, I think you could take this. But she's going to listen to this and be like, nope. James told me it was a horror movie.
Well, let me say this. It's definitely a horror movie, but it's not scary.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. It's horror in that it uses horrific elements and it deals with horrific events. Incest, murder, possibly ghosts. Though, did you guys get the impression that the ghosts might have just been a metaphor?
I
know they said at the beginning of the movie, but I was wondering if that was a theme or I don't know, because it was really subtle.
I had the luxury of watching just today before we met. I watched an interview with Christopher Nolan interviewing Del Toro, and he very much, I mean, he says he's had a couple of ghost experiences in his own life, so he believes they are real, but that mm-hmm. they function more in that way. The way in which the ghosts function, or the way that I think fundamentally he understands the existence. That idea, even The Grudge has a bit of that, just almost like a stain, a psychic stain and a lingering mm-hmm. of either the spirit or what happened there, that those are things that are real. So I'd say in one sense Edith says they're metaphors for the past. So they are real, but that's also the function they serve for the living, I guess, is the way I saw that.
I was using heavy satire. I thought that this was one of the least subtle films I've seen this year. Which is not to say I did not enjoy it. I just like rolled my eyes real hard when she was like, the ghosts in my story are a metaphor. I was like, okay. Here we go.
Oh, I loved it because it felt like Guillermo del Toro was aware enough that people wouldn't get it because it's such a not current thing.
It was clearly a man who has spent a lot of time working in a language that is not his own and is used to being misunderstood. So he's like, I'm just going to make sure everyone's real clear about what's happening. These are a metaphor.
Oh.
Well, here's a question. Have you guys seen The Devil's Backbone?
I have not.
I have not either.
It is not about a man and woman and that type of relationship. It's about these children in an orphanage, but the function of the ghosts and the way that they deal with the way that they are involved with characters who have conflict in the story, it's very much the same. So it really felt like he was just bringing an Americanized version of Devil's Backbone in some ways, which
nice.
I don't know if that'll make people. So if you love Crimson Peak, you should. If you enjoyed it, you should watch Devil's Backbone.
Who did Devil's Backbone?
Is it Del Toro?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like when, and oh, here's a horrible example. It's kind of like when John Woo did the second Mission Impossible, which I thought was terrible, mm-hmm. and it just looked like he was hitting all of his greatest notes from all of his foreign films, or for him they wouldn't be foreign, but right, it looked like he was suddenly like now it's Tom Cruise holding doves, and it's just like, all right, you're kind of just hitting all your greatest hits. There is an element of Del Toro has brought some things that were done in his foreign language films into this Americanized version. So I think, anyone who enjoys Crimson Peak on any level ought to watch Devil's Backbone. Fun, very different story. It has elements of Pan's Labyrinth and Crimson Peak, and it really, kind of like how you can see Tim Burton repeating themes, but it's still interesting.
Right. Right.
It's the Backbone really has, you can see how it's fueled and informed all of his subsequent works.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say about the film, if you've already seen the trailer, you've already seen all of the jump scares.
Oh, yeah. All of, yeah.
And oh, so, yeah. Like literally. So if you could make it through the trailer, you'll be fine in the movie. Yeah. Because they're spaced out more than 3 minutes apart. Hmm. So,
yeah.
Or if you've watched any old 50s and 60s horror movies and thought to yourself, man, these aren't really scary. Like if you've watched all of those kind of old black and white scary movie or Twilight Zone and those, and you're just like, well, this doesn't make me have nightmares at night. Like, then you're probably safe with Crimson Peak. It harkens back to that era of what scary or horror used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the thing over the next day after I saw the film, I kind of, Laura's really enjoyed me doing this thing where I, over the course of about the same time it takes to watch the movie, briefly sum up what happens in the movie. And every time I was like, and then there's this thing. She's like, oh yeah, but I saw that in the trailer. I was like, yeah, you saw all the times that there were things like that in the trailer. And she was like, oh, okay, cool. And so, like I said, so I think, you know, anyway, I'm excited for it to like come out, because we'll probably go, anyway, I will watch it again. And when I tried to describe to her, like, she said, well, what genre is it? And I said, okay, this is the, this is the supernatural romantic mystery thriller. She's like,
that's pretty good.
She's like, what does that even mean? I was like, I don't know. I really don't know. But I said, ultimately, it reminded me of a lot of other Del Toro stuff. It was a story that was just a little bit left of center, with fantastical elements just kind of sprinkled in to make you, you know, think that maybe this isn't fantastical. Maybe this is real life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I will sound like I criticized the film. I enjoyed it immensely once I had adjusted my expectations.
Oh, yeah.
And that happened in the first, like, after her encounter with her mom at the very beginning of the film, when I had already seen, like, two of the major jump scares that are in the trailer, and it was, you know, 3 minutes into the film, I thought, okay, this is a different movie than I was expecting. I better, like, sort of ease back on my expectations. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I would say that, like, I read enough reviews talking about kind of what kind of movie it was without trying to read any type of spoiler, that by the time I went into it, I didn't have to make an adjustment. I was like, wow, I see what people were trying to describe, and I'm completely digging on this. I think, like, the only, most of the negative reviews I read of this film were, that wasn't scary. I mean, yeah. You know, dot, dot, dot. I was really thorough.
Because I had been preparing myself for months to be leaving the theater, like, weeping and nearly insane. That's not the film I got.
So I think, and we might not all agree with this, but one of the reasons that I link the birth movies death review for you guys is because I thought it was a very apt description of what this film is, because he said Pacific Rim was where Del Toro gave his inner 13-year-old boy free reign, and Crimson Peak gives equal time to his inner 13-year-old girl. A gothic romance, Crimson Peak is all about decaying mansions and withered aristocracy, sweeping heroic love, and bitter villainous betrayal. And I was like, yep, that was it. That was it.
I'm comfortable with that. I mean, and you know, I think maybe I'm in the weird, and I don't know if this is helpful for folks like your wife to go see the movie, but it, from Del Toro's lips, even though he said it was gothic romance at one point, he still would use the word horror, and that he said that ultimately the movie is about the love of horror and the horror of love, and so yet, and it's like, all right, so horror is a component, but yet ultimately it's about that appreciation. Again, for the 13, right? It's the same reason I even love watching old things like the old 60s Dark Shadows. It's candles and it's cobwebs and candelabras. I mean, it's just that mood, and that I would use the word spooky. It's like, what versus scary? Like, Yeah, it's like when you go to a Halloween party or when you go to that. There's a spooky ambiance, but it's not terrifying or terrorizing in any way. And I love that about it because I think maybe I was one of the few people, and I don't think it's because I was smart. I guess I kind of hoped it was that, so it more met my expectations because I mean when I'm just bored, I'll put in one of those old 60s Hammer horror flicks, and it's that kind of. There's not a lot of jump scares, and there's not even a lot of terror elements. It's really just this ambiance that is there, and that's something I like. So it really worked for me on that level. I wasn't sure if that's what I was going to get. But it met my expectations, but I was very happy, and I caught it a second time down with some friends in California, and it even more a second time. Just really, it's a visual feast that. You can watch it ten times and just look at the visuals. Even I say the same thing about a lot of people didn't like or were indifferent to Tron Legacy, but I can again between Daft Punk's music and just the sumptuous, the costuming and it is a film that is just beautiful to behold, even if it's not a great movie. You know, I don't know.
Well, I think that'd be fair.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that I told you guys kind of at the beginning of the show or before the show, depending on where that edit takes place, is that both you guys are two of the biggest beater of the drums for horror films to be kind of consumed by Christians or by people of faith. And so, you know, we're saying whether we define this loosely as horror or as classically as horror, that, like, what, and I know we've kind of hit on this occasionally, and I don't want to just, like, keep talking about the same thing over and over, but, like, what value is there in using things like ghosts or zombies or vampires in our storytelling? And maybe why should we not be so afraid of doing that, JR?
Well, actually, my church just finished a 4-week series for the month of October where we talked about why cultures tell monster stories, and each week we did a different monster. And one of the reasons
can I go to your church?
Yeah, see, sure. I was going to say I'm so surprised, JR. I didn't realize that your church did this. How convenient that you're.
and actually, Clay, my Storyman co-host, preached on Sunday this past Sunday about ghosts. And the way he spun it is that, you know, ghost stories are all about unresolved issues, right? Every ghost story is that there's been some injustice or some past sin that has gone unnoticed or unatoned, and the ghost can't have peace until that is made right. But in reality, we are the ones who carry those unresolved issues with us, right? So we are haunted houses. We are the people whose issues are unresolved, which I think Crimson Peak illustrates beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting that rather than talk honestly about unresolved issues and anger and our tendency to live off of other people rather than live in a mutually giving relationship, we tell stories about ghosts and werewolves and vampires. Because as a culture, we find it easier to externalize these fears we have about ourselves and put them out there. So particularly what we told our church people over and over at the beginning of every sermon was, if the church is willing to look honestly at monster stories and face our fears, what we'll find is areas in our own selves and in our culture where we need healing. That's what the monster stories are covering up. So if we're willing to sort of scoot the monster aside and look behind and beneath the monsters, we find wounds in our own selves. And then as Christians, we can speak good news to those wounds, right? And offer the healing, yeah. The healing balm of the good news. So for me, I love moms. And it was fun in the sermon series, even to hear our church people, they got so excited about it. And we actually had several people come up this Sunday and say, I'm so bummed that this series is ending. Like, it's been so much fun, like so good. It's really cool when you give people permission to listen to these stories and tell these stories. They find a lot of beauty in them, ironically.
Mm. Well, I don't want you to. Well, I mean, I'm going to ask you to, but I don't necessarily want you to completely spoil your sermon series because obviously it would be great if people went back and had a chance to listen to those fully. But can you kind of run down that list? Like what we talked about Ghosts, and specifically with Crimson Peak, we're obviously talking about Ghosts and unresolved or unatoned for actions. But like, what do zombies do? What do vampires do?
So I'll actually give fair credit. We actually stole this idea from Matt Michalotis' book, Night of the Living Dead Christian, where he does the same thing. Why if Christians are supposed to be living new life, do we so often live as though we're still dead? Mm-hmm. And so vampires are people who live off of other people, right? I mean, they take life to live. And so we talked about vampires as people who drain the life out of you. You mm-hmm. know, that person, when they leave a room, everyone collapses in a heap and they're like, oh, I'm just exhausted from being around this person. And so we talked about what to do if you know a vampire, and then what to do if you are a vampire, and how to tell if you're a vampire, because often, ironically, vampires don't seem to know that they just take and take and take and take. We talked about werewolves as the person who has that creature inside of them that, despite their best efforts, seems to get out and hurt people. And so the next time they cage it back up and they try to build a better cage with different behaviors or different routines or different checks. And the story of the werewolf is that it always gets out of its cage, you know, no matter how good the cage is. And then with zombies, we talked specifically about how, you know, the zombie, because there's like the voodoo mind control zombie where the stories originated, but that's not like the zombies of the Z Nation and the Walking Dead, or that these reanimated corpses mm-hmm. reduced to their primal instincts, which is to consume. And those zombies became popular in the 60s as we were sort of coming off of the crest of the post-World War II, you know, prosperity boom of the 40s and the 50s. And we were starting to realize that the good news of consumerism didn't actually seem to be all that good, because we were in our second land war in Asia mm-hmm. and the civil rights movement was booming at home. And so we were realizing that when we said everyone gets this, it didn't actually mean everyone, even in our own country.
Yeah.
And so then we get these monster stories of these humans that are stripped of everything except their most basic desires. And then they're just terrifying. And so we talked about how, as believers, we don't have to be afraid of our desires, because when God makes us new, God makes our desires new as well. And we can actually trust the things that our hearts want as things that are orienting us towards God, and that actually trusting the things that we love as a part of how we discern what God is calling us into as a vocation.
Mm. So thank you so much for that, JR. I'm going to make sure that if anyone's interested in maybe like listening to those sermons or kind of dive into that further, then we'll make sure I'll have that in the show notes as well.
Yeah,
link to the series.
Listening to the sermon, I'm looking up real estate in Texas. Where did you say you're from?
Dallas. Mikey's moving here too. So,
That makes it easier. James, if you move to Dallas, then I will seriously consider. I mean, that'd be like the trifecta. I'd be so happy. My wife may kill me and/or divorce me for moving to Texas, but
she had a pretty good time in Baylor last year, right?
Oh, we had a great time. I mean, it's one of those things where people overcome subcultures, kind of, you know, community overcomes culture.
You guys heard that Norwegians use the word Texas as slang for crazy, right?
Oh yeah, I thought that was amazing and very apt.
I know that now.
James is bringing it back. He's gonna be bringing it back to Seattle.
Weirdly, nice. A bunch of people posted it on my newsfeed as though I were responsible for it.
Well, I mean, it's pretty convenient that comes out around the, you know, just a year after you've been there.
Yep.
So I'm not saying there's a coincidence, but I'm not saying that there's not a coincidence.
I got for Ebola too, right when I moved down here.
Also coincidental. Yeah. These are like facts that people bring out when they want to prove some kind of like overarching like political point or something. They're like, well, as you all know, I'm like, no, those have nothing to do with each other.
I mean, we can't definitively say that I brought Ebola to Texas, but the timing was suspect.
Oh, just putting those ideas in people's minds. Yeah. Yeah. So, James, I don't necessarily. I mean, if you want to add anything to that question, you are welcome to.
Ghosts. Getting back to ghosts, the ghost thing. It's pretty interesting. Hearing Del Toro talk, he said he was specifically not. He makes a comment that he wasn't. His portrayal of ghosts was that he was trying to steer differently from typical Judeo-Christian themes. Mm-hmm. And yet, what was so fascinating, I was like, well, man, I don't think you've missed the mark, because as we've been saying, here we have these ghosts that are actually seeking it deals with unresolved issues. And I got a very distinct Jacob Marley feeling. I mean, absolutely. Here we have, mm-hmm. we have these women in chains, effectively. They're chained to this place and they're bringing a warning. Now, to be fair, Marley was bringing a warning to Scrooge in A Christmas Carol about his sin. And then, I mean, he was trapped by his own sin. And in this, obviously the women are trapped because they've been sinned against in this place. So mm-hmm. it's different, but they're serving that same function of they're scary. And even Scrooge says to Marley, like, please, you know, speak comfort to me. And Jacob's like, I have none to give. Like, these women are showing up in these horrible ways that aren't comforting, but they're actually there truly to be helpful. And so there was a distinct Christmas Carol aspect to it in my head, where it's just like they're seeking the betterment of Edith, and yet it comes in a way that is not wanted. I mean, it's like she wants these things to stop. She wants to get away from Crimson Peak, but they're actually helping her unravel. I mean, and in one way, it could have been helpful. It could have been helpful. It doesn't work out helpful for Thomas, but in a sense, then even she's seeking to try to save and liberate and change Thomas as well. That doesn't work out, but they're seeking in some way to provide a redemptive element, which kind of gets to my one sentence summary, which I never am able to give you, and you didn't ask. Now the one time I have one, you're always like, you'll boil
hey, James,
it down. What's your
James? Do you happen to have like a one sentence summary that you could maybe throw at us? If you could think of something like off the top of your head, I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Funny you should mention that, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
I would say Crimson Peak is about the miasma of human existence and the need for otherworldly intervention to break free from it.
Oh, man.
Ooh.
So now we have to sit and brood on that for a while.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I've been teaching about this. We just hit it, oddly enough. It's connected for me, where we're preaching through First Samuel. And we've just hit this place where in 1 Samuel 11, the Ammonites are oppressing Israel. But you actually run that back, and it's because these people, this whole nation, is the product of Lot's incest with his daughter. So you've got this act of sexual deviancy between two consenting adults that, I mean, maybe that's not a big deal, but it ripples out into this generational legacy of adversarial nature that is now you have nations at war with one another. Like, we don't see the ripples and stain of human legacy and sin. And that to me works. That shows up in the house. It shows up in Crimson Peak in the way that Lucille has been broken. Like, as much as she is the villain, In every way, she's been broken under the weight of the world. Mm-hmm. She's taken the oppression of a mother and a physically abusive father, and she's just taken it to that next logical step. Now she's, you know, I mean, like that. If that's what you've got to work with, and then she's taken on, she was forced into the role of mothering, and then even, you know, mother, sister, kind of lover, everything to Thomas, It's because from the beginning she's experiencing corruption. It's that snowball effect of multi-generational sin rolling through human history, and that's why you have the whole building is you know, rotting and festering, and blood's, you know, red is bubbling up beneath the floorboards, and everybody's kind of caught in their station. Like, there's that great comment that's given, you know, it's like, well, I think it's Hunnam's mom. Right, says, you know, we'll find, everyone has their place. We'll make sure you find yours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Thomas is caught. Even, you know, Thomas is caught between his sister and the fact that even he goes to Edith's dad, and it's, you know, he assumes this is just a guy born of privilege, but actually he's the product of benign neglect and abuse, and warped by his older sister. He wants to work hard. He wants to create something. He wants to redeem his household legacy, but he's been totally corrupted and compromised, and there's blood on his hands, and he can't have what he wants, but neither can Edith. Like, that's why I think there is some chemistry between them, because she's a woman in a time when she cannot be respected for her writing. Nobody will take her seriously. No one mm-hmm. will take him seriously. And so that is where their mutual anguish kind of creates that romance.
And he kind of finally makes that connection with somebody else.
Yeah.
In a way that he's not able to do it with Jessica Chastain, or, you know, Lucille.
Yeah. And so that to me was just like, man, we've got this stench of everything is broken, And the only thing that allows Ida, the one character that's able to transcend and then actually not be the damsel in distress, but actually Charlie Hunnam's the damsel in distress.
Isn't he always, though? I mean...
Well, maybe not in Sons of Anarchy. I'm trying to think. But, oh, yeah, 100%. But here he gets to... Like he shows up. She is only freed by the intervention of this other dimension of supernatural intervention. Without that, she would have been utterly lost and just fallen victim. And so there's nothing specifically. It's like some movies are so very, you got your Matrixes and your other movies that are overtly Christian. This is very subtle, but something has to happen that's transcendent to break through to give her the keys to release. It's similar to Pan's Labyrinth in that way.
Hmm. Well, I like that. I like that idea because it was something that I started to have conversations with people about like how Proverbs, mentions that he who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but then there's this act of confession that follows, and that confession is like freeing, and it's there where someone will finally find compassion, and I would go as far to say as not just compassion but healing, and then there's like that freedom too, and it's not just about this personal weight lifted. It's if you put that on the larger scale, that's a microcosm of what the gospel is. Like we admit that we can't do it, just like you're saying, James, we have to kind of realize that we need something outside of ourselves, or else we just kind of snowball and until it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And if we would have just kind of turned at the beginning, or like realize what the issue was, or realize that we can't just keep looking inward, which is funny because I feel like most of the films that I see or that I watch year to year for the past couple years, so many of them, this was Iron Man. This was like the realization that there was a need for redemption, which is great. But then the summation is almost, or the conclusion is almost always, look inward, try harder, and make it happen. And that's where I was like, I can see that, not just in our films, but how that's a reflection of what we think in culture. Like, you fell down, work harder. You can do it by yourself. You've got it in you. You've got that human spirit. And I think that's a fall. It's a lie. It's a false promise. But I think we see that here. So something that I didn't prepare either of you guys for, but I'm assuming that you've been asked this before in some form, is since this film is about ghosts, or, well, I'm sorry, it's a love story that has ghosts in it, technically. It's a metaphor. So theologically, where should we stand on ghosts? Is that even a thing? JR?
I mean, there are ghosts in the Bible.
Okay. So how odd would it be if someone said they saw a ghost, would you believe them?
Oh yeah. I mean, we lived in a haunted house, so I'd have no problem with that.
Okay. Where would be some of the first places you would go to in our G-rated Bible, where nothing scary or weird happens?
First Samuel chapter 28.
That'd be the first place you'd go?
Yep. Saul is mourning the death of Samuel. He is preparing for battle with the Philistines. He has lost all confidence that God will deliver him, and so he seeks out a witch, which he had previously banned under Samuel's instruction.
Mm-hmm.
The witch summons the ghost of the prophet Samuel, who then says, "Hey, you're real dumb, and you're going to die, and you and your sons are going to be with me tomorrow."
By the way.
Yeah, I mean, that's paraphrased, roughly. And that's how the story is presented. Everyone in the story, from the witch to Samuel to Saul, treats this as an actual appearance of Samuel after his death.
Not a metaphor to reflect sins of the past?
If you want to do it that way, you can, but that's not how the text treats it.
Mm.
When Jesus appears to his disciples after his resurrection, And they think he's a ghost. He doesn't say, don't you guys know there's no such thing as ghosts? He goes, no, I'm not a ghost. Touch me. Give me some food and I'll eat it. Like, I'll show you I'm not a ghost.
Because he's a zombie. Duh.
Right, obviously. Yeah. So at minimum, we have to say that the worldview of the scripture assumes that ghosts are real and that they're different from demons. Now, again, we're free to reject that worldview. Much as someone who's not a six-day creationist would reject the scientific worldview or the pre-scientific cosmology of ancient Near Eastern culture, we're free to do that. But at minimum, we have to say that the worldview of the scripture assumes that these are real things.
Okay. James.
What would you add? I might fall somewhere in the middle. It's not something I've thought about a ton. I would say my speculation, and if I had to speculate about a lot of the quote unquote ghost activity that we have seen throughout the last, particularly ghost situations over the last, 500 years, even mm-hmm. some of the ghost hunter stuff that happens now, I would speculate there is something in me that just assumes that the demonic and the spiritual forces that are negative, probably some of that are demons messing with people. So when you think of, like, what are they doing in the 21st century, the 20th century, then what do they have to do? How are they messing with our worldviews? How are they plaguing us? That seems like, there's nothing worse than showing up as a spirit of someone that you care about or have lost and having some torment or having a place can carry a dark stain. And so my speculation is some of that is masquerading.
Okay.
But I also can't argue with scripture. And just because scripture gives me a normative, it gives me a normative of this is the way it works, and then when we die, the judgment, etc. Scripture many times paints things as normal, and people love to argue that God does not normatively jump in and do things like harden hearts like he does with Pharaoh. People always want to argue that is something he does, but it is not necessarily normative because they like to have a different understanding of our will. So if I take that and say, so there's a normative, but then God does do other things. So if there's a normative that most of us pass away and then we are then in the presence or then we are at the judgment, well, that doesn't mean there can't be God-given exceptions to the rule, like Samuel, and then like others. So I think our mysterious God, I have to think some of that has been allowed in addition to just, if I have one story of Samuel, then there has to be other times he's leveraged his freedom in that. So,
and specifically what I mean, I have this conversation pretty often. Someone will come up to me and say, I went to a psychic and they told me some things that were accurate or I had a ghost encounter or whatever. What do you think about that? What I always say, well, the Bible never says these things don't happen. It very clearly says don't mess with them.
Hmm.
Right. That's the instruction. Not, hey, don't worry. Mm-hmm. Those things aren't real. It's no, don't. And so I'll, like, particularly with someone who's saying, I want to have a conversation with a psychic. I'll say, well, why? And it's always because they want assurance or they want direction. Well, those are things that we're supposed to get from God as believers, not from anyone else, right? Whether it's a psychic or a life coach or whatever. Not, again, not that a life coach can't be working in concert with the spirit, obviously, but
yeah.
But if we're what always is happening when someone is seeking the supernatural is that they're craving things that we ought to be getting from God from somewhere else, and that's idolatry. And so that's why again and again and again we don't see in scripture those are silly superstitions, they're not real. It says, oh, actually they're real and they're pretty dangerous, you should stay away from them, because God is the source of everything that you need. So
yeah, and that's where I think this film doesn't play to those things, because we actually have a character who is actively seeking to close her eyes and shy away from, like, they're forced upon her, they're not sought. And so I have to think at some point, if God allows a Samuel to show up and rebuke Saul, it's like, if you're not seeking these things and
they still show up,
something happens. If the Jacob Marley thing happens in our lives, it's like, well, there has to, that must have been in a, like, somebody's allowing that. Either God's allowing that as a test for us, or God's allowing that to convey a message to us. Mm-hmm. And either we need to discern, either we need to walk away from that, or it's like, oh, it may be like speaking through a donkey. You've done something strange here. I need to pay attention to. Like there's,
that's you're saying that's not normative.
Maybe in North Carolina.
I don't know. Francis the Talking Mule was a thing, but when I was a kid. But I'm not sure those are normal. A Shrek, right? A donkey? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, not normal. So I think that there is room for that under God's heaven, because there's so many things we don't know. But I certainly, again, seeking after those things. And you know, when I was not walking with Christ, there was some titillation and fascination, and actually sort of going to some places that were haunted and kind of seeing if I could have an encounter. And those are probably unhealthy times. And that's, again, not something we should seek. And so if somebody's loving these types of films and it's encouraging sort of a seeking out, if it encourages some real world seeking, well, then you know what? Probably not healthy. And that's why I like horror movies or these, you know, gothic romance, these types of darker features don't have to be for everyone. If they're, you know, the alcoholic does not need to be frequenting the bar.
Yeah.
If they're going to incite me to go seek out experiences in real life to mimic things, well, then no. If like metaphors, they're going to remind me of truths, then these can be totally positive films.
No, I think that's a really wise statement, because it harkens back to something I said, obviously. No, because I think that's the problem that most especially Christians or people of faith, or you know, whatever background you come from, have with horror films. They're like, you know, what good can come of this? It's just going to lead people. They're going to watch Harry Potter. They're going to turn into a witch. Then they're going to turn into a black cat, and then they're going to explode. Because that's what happens in that order. And you're like, wait, question, you know, like, that doesn't make sense. But there are things that we can get from these. But at the same time, just like too much alcohol or, you know, watching too many romantic comedies giving you this false understanding of what love actually is. It's not, you know, sleeping with someone on the first date and hoping they call. Like, we're watching too many horror films, or watching the wrong kind of horror films, ones that are, you know, what they was it gore porn kind of stuff like that?
Torture porn.
Like things like that. Like obviously you're not going to have a lot of thematic weight there that may be worth your time, much like some other, just like any other genre. And I think it's unfortunate that horror kind of gets saddled a little bit easier this way. But then again, when, you know, you keep just kind of churning out, oh, I don't even know, you know, just whatever they churn out, just because you can make a film for $6 million and you know it's going to make 45. Like they're
Paranormal
not even,
Activity 74.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's just not very helpful. But if you can find films, and I almost wish The Conjuring didn't come out at a time before we were really getting into this podcast, because I think it'd have been an amazing one to talk about. And I know that, yeah, exactly. And that's
amen. Watch the Conjuring.
Yeah, because you made the same reference last year when we were talking about Cabin in the Woods. You know, like it's oh, if you watch that and you see what they do in that film, that's something that you have to wrestle with, as opposed to something that's just going to be jump scares for, you know, an hour and 20 minutes. And that's what I hope people will kind of take away from, especially like our Halloween episodes, that we're intentionally engaging something that most people don't want to engage with, but it's out there. And not only should they engage with it because it's there, or at least consider it because it's there, but there's actually a lot here that is way more profitable than watching, you know, God's Not Dead or whatever other movie those guys would make.
Holy
you know?
Ghost.
Yeah. You know, so there's a lot of value here. Like I said, as with anything else, you know, with, I like what you're saying, James, with a lot of discernment.
Which is why it's always good, like with any film, hopefully, especially if you listen to this podcast, you're discussing these films in community with people, right? And being able to have honest conversations about what worked, what didn't, why you were attracted to certain things, why other things didn't work, you know.
Well, let's talking about horror tropes. You mentioned sex stuff. Let's talk about sex in Crimson Peak for just a minute, because I think that's.
Are we talking about Tom Hiddleston's butt?
I mean, you know, for better or worse, we saw Tom Hiddleston's butt. It is what I would call a mild sex scene, but a mild sex scene. If depending on your Christian community,
yes,
maybe it's wild. I don't know.
She was in a full dress, y'all.
Oh my goodness, that's horrible. No, it was fascinating to me. Again, I caught this interview with Del Toro, and it really sparked a curious thought. I think it can make a great discussion if you see this film to talk about sexuality in movies. The typical thing about all the slasher movies and the horror movies that often Christians won't see. If you've seen Scream or any of the other movies, you know, there's sort of the rules are like you have sex, you're going to get killed, which is a fascinating discussion in and of itself. But there's this whole idea of like the virgin survives, which is weird in most horror movies. And of course, in this story, that is not the way it goes. And Del Toro specifically said he not only didn't want to make a movie where, if you notice, the men are effectively useless and it's the women that are the strong ones. It's the women.
And the sociopaths, which is unusual.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The women are and I'd say more than Mad Max. Everybody wants to trumpet Mad Max this year as this like great female empowerment movie, which I think is like that's another discussion. I don't know if I entirely agree with that. But this is actually a movie I think surpasses that. I mean, it actually has the females on both sides of the conflict are the strong controlling characters. The women are the ones who actually have the power. But not only that, but we have an element of redemption. And I'm not saying the redemption is due to sex, but here you actually have, you know, there's not the remaining of a virgin, but actually sexuality occurs in that case within the bond. It is within marriage.
Right. It's like, still healthy, whole sexuality.
They are married, and it's actually that, and that's one piece of the relationship, but it's also a fulfilled and consummated piece of a married relationship that actually begins to liberate and change Thomas, and for not to a happily ever after, but you actually see he has decided he's done with the old ways. And so here you have actually this loss of virginity within the confines of marriage that actually has both an emotional and spiritual and sexual liberation for the character and actually helps change one of the characters and actually is healthy. Whereas we see the outside of marriage sexual deviancy that's been going on is actually part of what, which is funny to me. I mean, we walked down and we're talking to the ticket taker after the movie. And she was saying, man, everybody's coming out of the movie freaked out about the incest thing. Everybody was saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe this horrible thing. And now maybe I'm being weird, but I guess an interesting discussion would be, why do we have a gothic romance or horror film where marital relations on every level, including the sexual, are kind of a redemptive element to a character or the good thing? Why is incest so, in this day and age, why is brother and sister so scandalous? If we're in this era of redefining even marital and sexual mores, why are people leaving this film with this disgust? Like, there could be other things we could talk about outside of traditional marriage that could be. Like, I think there's discussion ground here. So there's a fascinating element. Like, why are we disgusted by this? Hey, if it's a brother and sister and they're consenting, what's the big deal? You know what I mean? Like, what? There's some curious questions that come out of this, but yet the movie definitely portrays it as just horrific.
Not even a little good.
Well, that's
this grotesque moment.
That's in part because particularly American horror has always been deeply conservatively sexual. That's why in every slasher movie, the virgin is the one who's able to kill the male killer who's usually killing people with some very phallic object, right? Yeah. I mean, why the ones who are killed are always transgressing sexually. I mean, that's like,
wait,
that's...
Wait a machete. I just got that. Okay.
So I mean, like there is something about like a deeply conservative sexual ethic in horror in general, and that's one of the things I was fascinated by with It Follows, right? Is that it sort of personified that trope as a monster.
Yeah, himself, yeah.
So I'm not particularly surprised that incest is still considered icky, particularly by a horror film audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of par for the horror course.
But I think what James hit on is that it does kind of plant a flag somewhere, and it makes you ask questions. And wherever you land on those questions, it still makes you ask those questions. And I love the fact that this film does enough things that subvert what we would think is happening. Like I said, when I was recounting this story very briefly over 2 hours to my wife, and she's like, "Oh, it's because this and this," and I didn't acknowledge it. I just kept pushing through, and then she'd be like, "What?" And, you know, and every time like I set something up just like the movie did, and then it didn't happen, or it happened in a completely opposite way, or like, you know, like in this case, they actually weren't sexual, deviants after their marriage. And I will concede, because I'm sure someone will comment or make the mention that, you know, Hiddleston's character, Thomas Sharp, was actually married before and technically still married. And so
not if she's dead.
Well,
yeah, he's a 3-time widower, right?
Yeah. And so I think there's lots to like dispel that. So I wanted to address it. and say that, yeah, so we're still seeing something that's very odd. You know, even the assumption by the characters in and of themselves, when Jessica Chastain's like, "Oh, you know, she shows her the Kama Sutra book and is like, "Oh, but you're well versed in all this now." And she's like, "Actually, he respected me, you know, and respected my mourning time." And it just kept like everything that you expected to happen when you see something coming up out of, you know, this red mud. You're like, "Oh, that's going to matter later." Doesn't matter later. You know, like when you see the ghost, you're like, "Oh, they're going to get her. And they're obviously there to harm her." They're not there to harm her. You know, like they're just all these things that keep, you know, the man shows
except
up.
Maybe the mom in the bathtub.
Well, but she still had the chance and she didn't.
Yeah, I was always suspicious of her her ultimate goals.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the mom and she probably had.
Right, that, especially for that reason, specifically for that reason.
Do you think, I'm going to say, I can't remember if I watched it a second time, something I would be very interested in is the color of the ghosts.
Yeah.
Because there was like black ones and kind of like maroonish ones and then like straight up red ones, like the mom in the bathtub.
Speaking of ghosts, can any of you explain to me why she saw her mom's ghost at the beginning, other than that so we would see a ghost more than an hour of film went by?
I think it just established that her character can see into a reality that most people aren't looking for.
So that's, we were meant to assume that she has like special psychic powers?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I, well.
Okay.
Spider sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm fine with that. Okay.
Did anyone else notice in the IMDb credits that Edith's mom, that first ghost we see, was played by Doug Jones?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, I thought that was great. I was making notes for the show and I was like, Doug Jones is the most hideous old woman and so scary. Which made so much sense. I love the fact that Del Toro like keeps putting him in movies, like these random things.
Yep. I was hoping Ron Perlman would make a cameo too.
Isn't it weird that he wasn't in there? Like, I feel like he should have just, like, been driving a stagecoach or something, just for a second.
Maybe
if he wasn't too old to be a legitimate love interest, I would have preferred him over Charlie Hunnam.
Well, I think most people... Yeah, there's a lot of... It's funny, the reviews were very, very, like, we don't understand what it is that Del Toro loves about Hunnam.
They're apparently, like, great friends. It must be, like, that he's... Like, I'd put you in my movie, Mikey, whether...
I would be in your movie, JR.
Like, wouldn't matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would put both you guys in my movie.
See, and so. That would be a mistake because I am not great on the stage. So.
Oh no, I'm terrible, dude. I like writing and I like breaking down, but I've come to the terms with the fact that the acting passed me by. I've tried to be in videos and stuff. I just don't do it.
I've come to accept the fact that I'm fantastic. So I'll be the star.
They'll be like that Harleman guy, great. What those other two jokers are doing, no one has a clue.
No, what it would be is like James Harleman as J.R. Forresteros.
Oh, I like, you know? That.
There,
yeah.
We go. There we go.
That'd be great in all kinds of ways.
You know, I thought I I'm gonna geek out for just a minute, even if hopefully it won't get us off track too much. But
yeah, do it.
Hunnam's character being a little bit cheesy, and the fact that like leaves and different things can come in through perpetually through a roof.
Yeah.
That seems to be in a at the top of a peak where there's no trees and
Was it just snow? Was there leaves?
No, it was leaves.
Okay, never mind then.
Oh yeah, tons of leaves. There was all of the strange flourishes, like characters acting like almost overacting or chewing scenery. Until the end of the movie, I felt like I was having a problem with it. But here's my straight. Did you guys stay through the credits at all?
Not till the very end.
At least through the visual credits when it kind of closes on the book.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
See, I don't. Here's my conceit. Here's what I believe is the conceit of the film. We're not watching a story. We're watching Edith Cushing's book.
I'd buy that.
Yep.
Because I mean, the editor mentions how her writing has flowery loops. Like, yeah. Like that. There's this floweriness to it, and so you have things like the leaves. You have this surreal world. Because it's being written by this woman raised in the household of her, like she's writing the romance. Even some of the critique that Hiddleston's character gives, the editor mentions that she stresses the ghosts. I mean, she's right at the beginning of the movie. She says, "Well, the ghosts in my story are just metaphors for the past." Mm-hmm. The editor says she should add a love interest or romance. And if you actually stop and think about it, if Hiddleston's character, if Thomas never fell for her, you could still have that tale work. You could still have the two of them conspiring against her, and you could have it work out another way. If you actually change it so they actually fall in love, that could be an editorial change. The editor says she should change and have a love story. I think we're watching an isolated woman's gothic romantic interpretation of love, and that's. I think we're watching Edith Cushing's book.
I'd buy that.
She says she's going to sit down and type it. She's like, I want to sit down and change it tomorrow. I'm going to sit down and type the whole thing. And she sits down to type it, and then Hiddleston walks in.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're watching her book. Like I think there's a conceit there, which then to me then it ameliorates any of my artistic questions. Like, oh, of course this character is a little too much or a little overwrought.
Yeah, a little
We're watching this woman's story, and to that, it totally made it all make sense to me. And so that's it. Actually, added an element that made me love it.
It definitely does help a lot with my come on moment. So that which is good because I didn't really have a lot. So, like James pointed out, like JR affirmed and I affirmed. Like the one of the cool parts is that this is going to obviously incite a lot of questions, or can incite a lot of good conversation, just from the genre that it may or may not be, to some of the elements that are used in the film, to the characters' reactions and the things they're running or not running from. We're just scratching the surface like usual in most films. But we're getting to that point where we need to probably start winding it down a little bit. So we're going to do that again, like usual, by talking about things that really did kind of bug us, our come on moments. So, James, if there was something in this film that isn't explained by, I think, your very on point observation about it probably just being the story, what would it have been?
I love the mood. I love the ambiance. I was writing the film pretty much the entire way, with a couple of question marks that then were kind of hit by that realization at the end of that sort of pictorial credits.
Yeah.
I just got this aha moment. The one thing that kind of didn't work, or I said, really, I felt like if this movie is about this gothic flourish. And all of this kind of over the top drama, I felt like the climax fell a little short. That's where I felt there were so many beautiful, considering the beauty of the rest of the film, when she just sort of smacks her with a shovel
and gives the one liner.
I expected Chastain's, I expected Lucille to fall like back into the machine and be kind of ground into the red and the crimson. I expected a dramatic climax, and I feel like it was a little, for a film that nowhere went for understatement, it felt like suddenly it was understated. I was like, that feels strange. I get with watching it a second time, I was really unhappy the machine didn't play more of a climax. I understood watching it a second time. I now understood. Okay, wait a minute. Thomas Sharpe's ghost, the machine is a metaphor for his ghost. Like he is backdropped against it. So then the fact that Lucille turns and sees the machine and sees him, the machine isn't meant to be the climax, the thing that the instrument of death. It's meant to actually be the metaphor for him. Like his spirit was in that. And so I get what they were going for there, but even then she could have fallen down and because the weight of her impact could have made the snow turn red with crimson all around her and something like something more. I wanted more pageantry at the end, and I felt like they suddenly went for a note that kind of made it fall flat, and that to me brought it back from being a perfectly beautiful film to enjoyable. I saw it the first time and I thought it's good, not great. I was like, well, I don't think it was. I like it's somewhere in the middle for me, and that was where that the climax just fell a little short. I feel like he could have artistically had some more beauty to it. And like JR was saying, the ghosts are the heavy-handed delivery that felt like pandering narration. I think we could have actually dropped the opening and ending pieces of narration. Almost could have just, I would love to see it without them and just see if the visuals alone would convey enough, because that felt like kind of like people complain about Blade Runner and Harrison Ford's sort of like the over hammy narration sort of dropped in because producers felt like people wouldn't understand it. I'd almost like to hit the mute button on the words and hear that without it, because that felt like heavy-handed. We think the audience is stupid. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt at least first.
So when you describe what you just described, I think I just had a realization, and I might be the very last person to this party right now, but it completely made sense to me through most of the film that Edith was the only person that saw these ghosts. And I assumed that when Lucille turned around, she actually saw Tom Hiddleston's ghost. And it freaked her out, but are you implying, which I think makes more sense, that she still didn't see Hiddleston's ghost? She saw the machine behind it and just started thinking of him as like that was him.
I think it's deliberately ambiguous.
Okay, because I didn't even think about that, because that would be brilliant. Because you would hold to the conceit of the entire film that like they still have no idea how Edith knows all these things. Because she can see something that no one else can, but that machine is a reflection of who Thomas was. Everything that they did was of Thomas was in that machine,
and that it works, and that it's going to save the house, you know, rebuild the family. Except it won't, because it's rotten from the inside.
Yep.
Metaphor.
Oh, metaphors. All right, JR.
Mine was the metaphor thing. Like, I don't like it when a movie wants to hold my hand. I get it. I'm a smart guy. I know how to watch movies. So I rolled my, like, Amanda and I looked at each other and we were like, blah.
Oh man. Well, so the thing that like bothered me, it was really about the only thing that did, because I didn't put these two things together, because I did feel like I was watching like a fantastic story, like someone was reading me a fantasy the whole time. So it, like I said, it didn't bother me that, you know, Hunnam was kind of like hamming it up, or you know, that things were falling through the ceiling or things like that didn't make sense, or it was a little over whatever. But for some reason, it really bothered me that Thomas Sharpe walks into that office and meets Edith. And glances down at one page of her story and says, oh, is this a story? Oh, it looks like it's about ghosts. Oh, this is really good. I'm like, no. Like, no one reads that fast. like Data doesn't read that fast. And he's like, you know, he flips through the second page. He's like, this is incredibly compelling. I'm like, what did you pick up? Like, what's her opening line? You know, like,
I don't understand. Who's this Data of which you speak? Are you some kind of nerd? I don't understand.
Excuse me. I'm surprised you don't know about Commander Data. But then, you know, if you make it a story and it's very convenient that he walks in and is immediately, kind of incensed or not incensed, but, infatuated with this, this Edith, then it makes more sense that way.
So, yeah. I figured he was just laying down some game.
Yeah. But even then,
so, I wrote a book and he's like, it's amazing. Like it's easily great. The best book I've ever read. What are you doing later?
But see, that's the thing. Like, it's even so fast that I'm not even sure how he got to the point where he knew anything about it, like, in 2 seconds.
Mikey, like, he knew that she wrote it. What else did he need to know?
Well, he describes it. He's like, oh, I like this thing that you did in it, and I like the fact that it's got this. And I'm like, no, you don't. Because if he would have just said, like, oh, it looks really great, I'd be interested in reading or reading
it. You sound
it
like a married guy who's been out of the game way too long.
That's what
it sounds like to me.
Out of the game so long.
Haven't you seen those infomercials for learning how to speed read, man? I'm just saying. You just right. Like, you look at it 2 seconds a page. That's what
boom.
I'm saying.
I wish I could do that. I wish I had time to read, period. I could read if I could speed read.
Need to watch more infomercials, man. It's out there.
If I took the time to watch more infomercials on the TV, I would know how to speed read.
That's right.
It's cyclical. all right. So we're ending on a high note. JR, what was your favorite part of this movie?
I'll say two different things. The father's death was appropriately gruesome and gut-wrenching. Like, I felt like the amount of gruesome that it was matched how terrible it was for the events of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was well done. And then I also, the first time she walks into the house, it was gorgeously horrific, and I appreciated the way the house functioned as a metaphor, particularly because they didn't tell me that it was doing that.
But weren't they, JR?
They didn't say, you know what, this house is sort of like a metaphor for our family. Like, it used to be beautiful and strong, and now it's kind of decrepit and decaying from the inside.
Oh, see, I actually thought he had enough lines that did that, because he was like, oh, we just can't keep it up anymore, because now it's just the two of us. We can't, you know, it's going to fall apart faster than we can fix it, kind of. I'm like, I get it. Isn't that close enough?
At least he didn't say it would usher in a metaphor.
Oh.
I mean, he did not literally say, this house is a metaphor for our family. Unlike what happened with the ghosts.
It will soon usher a fall of our house.
Yeah.
Of usher. Yeah. Yes.
And so, honestly, I mean, again, for me, that's the difference between, like, a really great homage to horror lovers and assuming that your audience has never seen a haunted house movie or read a story before.
Yeah, well, they talk about that. I mean, Christopher Nolan and Del Toro talk about, like, he absolutely wanted to hew close to the tropes and honor them without being pastiche. And you know, so there's that thing, like, did they go over the line at certain points? Did they cross the line, I think, with the heavy-handed dialogue? I think you have a point. I think with the house itself, I didn't think it crossed that line. I think it went up to the precipice,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and yet didn't quite go over there. And my favorite moment, Mikey, was honestly Chastain when they return from spending the night at the depot.
Oh, that was great.
And she pulls up that, there's visually, I'm not even sure how it happens. She swings that pan like she's going to beat Mia to death, mm-hmm. Edith to death. And yet she swings it and the breakfast goes all over the table. And the way that she's speaking, I mean, at this point, like, I don't know. I guess I knew from – I guess people were shocked at the incest. I kind of knew it from, like, day one. But that's – we're, like, from the first – when she's sitting at the piano and turns around and looks unhappy, I kind of knew. But to me, it was more about the seeing how the reveal happened. Not – like, to me, it wasn't a movie about having surprises. It was about how do things that are so obvious slowly creep, burble up into the light. And to her, that festering burble of under the surface, it was always like a boiling moment. And then she's scooping the hot food back into the pan. And I don't know, that that exchange between the two female, between the two actresses is probably my favorite moment of the film.
So to follow that up, I saw that disdain from Chastain as well.
Oh, nice. See
what you did there. But I guess my assumption was that they were actually married and not brother and sister. So you thought you thought incest the whole time, not just like married possibly under the table.
Well, there's in Fall. Well, to go back to Poe, Fall of the House of Usher. It's a guy. It's a brother and there's something weird. It's never quite explained in that old Poe story, but it is obvious in its feeling. It's kind of like, I mean, you go back to old stories and, I mean, people see, you go back and read Dracula. Nowadays, we don't see the deep brooding sexuality in it, but in that era, people understood it. Like, there's nothing ever stated. So that the incestuous nature turns up in a lot of those old stories. So I guess I was expecting it to be here. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. It wasn't off the table for me, but I was like, I saw it, but I didn't know which way it was going to go. I was like, is this going to be this way or this way? And yeah, because I think what you said was really good, obviously, because, you know, it wasn't really trying to hide that there was something there, but it was really kind of like, how would it unfold and would that kind of capture you? And I think it did. And maybe this shows, well, actually, I think it shows, I read a lot of reviews. And I was wondering if Del Toro basically knew the film he made, which was probably a dumb question on my part to ask, because he's done enough now that I think he knows exactly what he's doing. But right at the beginning of the movie, and I was wondering if like how much of a horror, how scary the film was actually going to be when Edith says, you know, it's not a ghost story, it's a story with ghosts in it. I just, that line made me giggle. I mean, like giddy giggle, like not like roll my eyes giggle. I was like, oh, this is so like self-aware, and it's telling the audience exactly like what the expectation needs to be, so people shouldn't be able to judge it this other way, which then made me even roll my eyes more at reviewers who were like, I don't get it. It wasn't scary. I was like, they told you right up front. So I hear, especially JR, your criticisms about how it was like all on the nose, but it's amazing to me that as on the nose as it was, it seems like people still just didn't get it. you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, listen. When I go to see a ghost story, a monster movie, I am expecting them to function as metaphors. Mm-hmm. And when they don't is when I rule it to be a bad film. So maybe that makes me in the minority, but
it shouldn't be the minority.
It should. That's what monster movies are. And so again, when you don't tell that, when you don't use them that way, you're wasting a good story. Yeah. So
it's like if you have a movie about like a possessed doll, and the whole movie is just about how crazy that doll can do things, instead of like learning the history behind that doll and how it became possessed in the first place. Like, those are the two directions that can go, and one is very right and one is very wrong. Maybe.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
And no.
Although the first Chucky movie is awesome, but go on.
Well, but in the first Chucky movie, like them trying to figure out how Chucky gets in the doll in the first place.
Like, yeah, that's
like the unresolved kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you don't agree with me, we can all take a vote after the show, and I can completely edit that part out, and then I'll continue to sound smart the whole podcast. It'll be amazing.
Oh, that's the funny. Beauty of it.
No, I mean, like, yeah.
The Boy is coming out. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for The Boy, but that it's a new doll movie with one of the actresses from Walking Dead. Looks hot. A lot of potential. Looks like it could make up for Annabelle, but anyways.
Hopefully, yeah.
All I see now is trailers for, I want to call it Into the Woods, but it's not Into the Woods.
Wait, what?
It's got, it's the one where the woman that's from, Game of Thrones is goes to like that, see your twin sister like at the woods below Fuji Mountain.
I haven't seen Japan. That trailer.
Oh yeah, no, that looks, oh yeah,
because it looks freaky. Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh,
horror and Asian culture. That is rife with potential.
It's almost like we're afraid of the other.
What does that mean? Well, outside of that, guys, we are. I think we're basically done. So, what I'd tell everyone out there is, like, you know, usual. There's everyone's got a different level. We've talked about this. Some things are good for some people. Some things are not. But if you aren't into gore stuff, I mean, there is some graphic stuff in this. But you know, I think it's well worth checking out. Age appropriate as usual, and you know, have some great discussions about it. Think about the things that you know, horror movies and ghosts and all this stuff can lead to. And I think if you like Del Toro, then I can't imagine you're not going to like this film on some level. So I actually like what Griffin said in his review for the Real World Theology site. He said, as he did in Pan's Labyrinth, he again draws you into a story that seems just off the edge of our own reality and encourages you to believe that maybe his stories just might be true. And I thought that was a great way to put it. So check it out if you get the chance. I want you to be able to keep these conversations going with James and JR. So James, where can people find you, conversate with you, or what you do around the internet? Or in real life, I guess.
In real life? Way. I mean, you can email james@cinemagog.com or check out the website, cinemagog.com. There's a Facebook page as well. Just search for Cinemagog. That's it, if you can figure out how to spell it. That's really the high bar that it sets. I'm not going to spell it for you here.
Okay. And James is usually super active on Twitter, so you can probably find him there too. Usually my Twitter feed is just like Harlem and Harlem and Harlem and Harlem and Harlem. And it's crazy. Also, not true. JR, JR, how can people follow you, keep the conversation going with you?
My website is cinemamagog.com.
Uh-oh.
That was a deep revelation joke that probably no one got. James got it. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
No, basically, if you find me at NorvalRogers.com, which is Shaggy from Scooby-Doo's real name, so you can just Google that if you can't figure out how to spell it. That's where I blog with the other Storymen. I have like 17 podcasts. My main one is Storymen, where we do pop culture, history, and theology. I also have the horror film podcast, Don't Split Up, that I do with my wife and a couple of my friends, where we are actually getting ready to record tomorrow morning our top 10 horror films for our podcast. So that'll probably be up shortly after this episode is available of Real World. So if you're listening to this, you can probably find that at don'tsplitup.com. And all my sermons are at jrforesteros.com, or if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you can find them there too, that Mikey was referencing. So those are the easiest places.
All right. Well, if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. If you've enjoyed it, we always really appreciate new subscribers, new reviewers. It really helps us kind of get our name out there, get more people involved in the conversation. And that's usually a really good thing. So we're very grateful for our super appropriate and excellent guests who have brought so much to this conversation. So please follow them on social media and around the web. I'll make sure I have all the links to all the things that they're involved in that they will allow me to have up on the site at realworldtheology.com. Meanwhile, we're very thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
Jump, jump, jump. I'm so cliche. I'm still just admiring that you live in Dallas and your name's JR, but
yeah. Weirdly, I didn't get very many of those jokes when I moved down here, and I was a
nice.
I was a little bit proud, but I was also surprised.
It's because they assumed you were already dead.
Yeah, I know. I got them growing up. Like every time I met anyone, they were like, "Who shot JR?" And I was like, "That's a weird thing to say to a kid that you're just meeting."
You guys, I was like, I was really excited to have you both on this episode because it's the Halloween episode, right? See, and all I have to do is say Halloween episode, and both of you react in the exact same way. It's not, you know, not scripted, not planned.